Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Next time you buy a lottery ticket or visit a casino, ask yourself how this might fit into your overall concept of leisure activities. That's exactly what Dr. Gordon Walker is looking at for the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. And biologist Robert Anderson of the Alberta Conservation Association is studying how fire suppression relates to poor winter range for deer and elk. And the Venture Prize Business Plan Competition presents its first entrepreneurial kickstart winner. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Go anywhere in Alberta, and you're never too far from a slot machine, VLT, or blackjack table. We hear a lot about the trouble gambling addiction causes in people's lives, but for many, gambling is just another form of recreation. Dr. Gordon Walker has studied recreational gambling for the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. Gordon is an associate professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Recreation at the University of Alberta. He also teaches a course called Life, Leisure, and the Pursuit of Happiness.
Well, I mean, from the life perspective, you know, the research suggests over 80% of Albertans gamble, so it's a pretty prevalent activity. In terms of happiness, I guess a lot of people would say that winning is why they do it, but there's other reasons. There's social aspects, there's risk-taking, and so from a happiness perspective, I mean, gambling's a good leisure activity to look at.
What aspects have you been looking at in your research?
I've looked at a few things with different colleagues. I started off looking at casinos and tourism with Tom Hinch. My own research, though, has primarily looked at gambling and culture and how culture might affect who gambles, how often they gamble, and that sort of thing. And then I've got a couple of other projects with a couple of other collaborators looking at things like gambling and corrections. And we're really interested right now with another colleague, Dan Mason, looking at where the gambling money goes that comes up in Alberta and how it's distributed and how much people know about it.
Looking at this aspect of gambling and culture, there are some cultures where gambling is more accepted than perhaps others, and I'm thinking of Aboriginal and Chinese cultures. What have you done in that aspect?
Well, I have done some research looking at prevalence, how often people have gambled in the last year. Gary Smith did some research and found, for example, that Ukrainians, self-identified Ukrainian Canadians, their rate was over 90%. So quite frequent. My own research has found with Chinese, for example, that it's around 60%, at least in Alberta, which is 20% below the average. So in some ways going against the norm in terms of maybe people's perceptions of Chinese gambling, it was actually lower. And in looking at some of the results from other places, that number seemed to be about right. So around 60% of Chinese said that they had gambled in the previous year.
How does that fit within their economic circumstances in life?
Well, you know, it's sometimes said that gambling is a tax on the poor. And typically what happens, especially with Euro British Canadians, is the poorer they are, the more likely they are to gamble. So as income goes up, gambling prevalence goes down. But with Chinese, we actually found that the opposite happened, was that Chinese who made under $25,000 a year were much less likely or much more prevalent to gamble, and those above $75,000, those that had disposable income, were more likely to gamble. So it was actually the reverse. It was more they had the money. They didn't have to maybe pay for basic expenses and support their family. And so they were the ones that were much more likely to gamble. So it was the reverse of what we usually see.
Why do you think it was the reverse?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think part of it may be just in terms of a lot of them are new immigrants. They're coming. There's so much else in terms of learning the language, learning Canadians' morals and systems, and so there's so much focused on work and getting ahead that they don't think about leisure. It's only after they've been here a while, they've become more acculturated, maybe they've succeeded economically, that they say, okay, now I can gamble because I have the money and it's not going to negatively affect my family.
When you look at the immigration from Asian countries, there's so many actually different groups within that. Does that make a difference?
I think it probably does, because now most of the immigrants that are coming, Chinese immigrants that are coming to Canada, are from People's Republic of China. And gambling is only relatively recently being accepted and approved by the communist government, in part to support the Olympics. It's buying lottery tickets so you can support the Beijing Olympics. So, I mean, that might be a factor as well, as they're not as exposed as Chinese who've come from Hong Kong, for example, or other Asian groups where gambling was more prevalent and allowed. One of the things that I found that was fascinating about Chinese, though, when I was going back and looking at the history of gambling, was that at least there's some research that suggests that the Great Wall was partially funded by lottery tickets 3,000 years ago or whenever. So, I mean, there is that part in terms of Chinese culture and history and gambling. But more recently, with the communist government, it's just been outlawed until the Olympics have come along.
Well, you mentioned lotto tickets. How does that fit in then with your overall general concern about leisure activities?
Well, I mean, typically we gamble in our free time. It's something that we voluntarily do. I mean, those are all leisure attributes. So, I mean, it fits in. I think lottery tickets are a little bit different because, you know, it's a relatively cheap and easy thing to do. But I think the leisure aspect probably comes with lottery tickets in terms of the dream of winning. I think last week there was a $300 million payoff in the U.S., and I mean, it's that aspiration of what would I do with $300 million? It's the fantasy aspect, which is just another kind of leisure. So lottery tickets would fit right in there.
In the research that you've done on this, how would you look at people who just have to get that lotto ticket?
Well, I mean, there's a few reasons. One, of course, is the fantasy of winning the million or the $100 million. I guess the other one that some researchers have talked about is called anticipated regret. And that's the regret of what happened if this week I didn't buy my tickets and my numbers came up. And there's sort of that negative reinforcement. And so I think some people look at it that way, is they're just scared. And I think there was a case in British Columbia, you know, in the summertime, where there was people who hadn't chipped in their money into the pool. And then there's a big lawsuit about should they get part of the lottery funds. And people are going, oh, I got to remember to put my money in because I don't want to miss out in case we win. And so there's the fantasy aspect with lottery tickets. There's anticipated regret in terms of what if I did win with my numbers, but I didn't have the ticket. So there's multiple reasons, I think, with lottery tickets.
One of the areas that you've looked at is tourism and casinos and gambling. What did you find in that research?
Well, casinos are often thought of as something that draws tourists to a city, and it does do that, but a lot of people who do use the casinos are locals. I mean, quite a few. And so one of the concerns is how many people does it attract? I guess one of the concerns would also be in terms of differentiation. I mean, somewhere like Edmonton or Calgary isn't going to be the same as Las Vegas, where people are drawn there to gamble, to do other things. I was trying to remember the slogan, something along the lines of what you do in Vegas stays in Vegas. It's not going to be the same. What you do in Edmonton stays in Edmonton. I don't think that's going to work. So from a tourism perspective, it does draw some people, but it's not as big a draw maybe as other things. And so I think you have to take that into account and really think about the economic benefits that maybe people get from tourism versus some of the costs that can go with gambling and casino gambling.
Why do people go?
Why do people go to casinos? There's all kinds of reasons. The one that people will often say, like lottery tickets, is because of the chance to win. But I think that's more top of mind. It comes out. But when we actually asked people, you know, beating your competitor or beating the casino, it wasn't that important. The kinds of things that people said were important were taking chances and risk and sometimes escape from your everyday problems. And really, the top one was communing, that sense of going with people and the social aspect and a sense of belonging. By far, that was the most common reason people said they went to casinos.
Now, how can that be social if you're sitting in front of a slot machine and you're plugging your quarters or dollars into it? Where's the social aspect of that?
Well, if you're doing that, unless the person's sitting next to you, you'd have to wonder, but it probably also depends on the game. So if you're playing cards, for example, it's very social and you're talking to the person next to you, and maybe you're trying to bluff and maybe you're trying to find out what's called a tell so you know what their cards are, versus something like a VLT machine, video lottery terminal, where you're just focused so much. On the other hand, if you think about a casino as a place that's separate, often without windows, you don't know the day or time, they don't have clocks. If you think of it that way, I mean, it is a place that's very isolated from other distractions, and you really could probably focus on the person next to you and see what they're doing and talk to them and have a social experience. So it is kind of strange, but again, at least with casinos, we found that that commuting aspect was by far the biggest motivation.
Were you surprised by that finding?
I was stunned by that finding. It was sort of the same question that you asked. But in going back and looking at the data, we found that bingo halls, for example, are well known for the social aspect. And so why not casinos as well?
There's an awful lot of money that goes into gaming in Alberta. Do you have any idea why so much money goes into it?
Well, I mean, you've got 80% of the population that gambles at least once a year. I think the numbers I've seen are, on average, people spend around $400 to $500 a year. That's a lot of money coming in. It turns into over $1 billion is the estimate for this fiscal year, $1.2 billion. And so, I mean, it's a huge amount of money. And I think one of the things that's really, really stunning about that is how quickly it's happened. I mean, beyond lottery tickets in the last 30 years, casinos are relatively recent. VLTs, and so there's sort of been this amazing escalation in terms of the amount of money that's come in and the amount of people that seem to be gambling. And I think it's fascinating in terms of how that's all happened, but also maybe in terms of what it may mean.
You've got a new project coming up that's going to look at the money. What's that about?
I'm working on a project with a colleague, Dan Mason, because we want to get an understanding of, do people really know how much money gambling brings in and where the province, the provincial government allocates it? Are they aware of it? Do they support it? And those are big concerns when you've got $1 billion plus every year to hand out to different places, like in some cases sport and recreation, but also everything from seniors' homes and hospitals to other places. And so we're really curious about, well, what Albertans think about where gambling money comes from and where it goes.
You're looking at the happy side of gambling. A lot of people look at the sad side of gambling. How do the two mix?
Well, I mean, the research suggests that probably about 1%, maybe 2% of people are problem gamblers. That means it affects them in terms of maybe lying to their family or economic problems or that sort of thing. Another 2 or 3% may have some signs of that, which leaves about 95% of people who gamble, 19 out of 20, who do it recreationally, go a couple times a year, don't spend too much money, don't have problems. So, I mean, I think you have to put it in that context. The problem is with those that do have problems is the problems are often so serious. It can be, you know, bankruptcy, it can be losing your family, and some research by Gary Smith would even suggest gambling's often tied to things like suicide. And so it's one of those two-edged swords for 95% of people who do gamble. It's not a problem. It's not an issue. It's just another recreational activity. But for those that do have problems, they can be very, very serious.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Gordon Walker, an associate professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Recreation at the University of Alberta. He's also a researcher with the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. During the winter, deer, elk, and moose like to forage for food along the forest's edge or in snow-covered meadows. Unfortunately, the open areas they depend on for winter range is diminishing at an alarming rate. And the problem is fire suppression. As a result, there's not enough young forest to support these animals. Robert Anderson is a wildlife biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association in Rocky Mountain House. He's involved in the development of a new program to improve the winter range for these ungulates.
Well, there's a number of key factors that go into making good ungulate winter range habitat. First of all would be forage. There has to be available forage for them at a key time of the year during winter. So generally south-facing slopes, they're warmer slopes that are free of snow due to wind blowing snow away. Those types of things are important to allow ungulates to access forage. But they also need to be able to avoid predators, and they also need to be able to be relatively free from human disturbance during a pretty important time of the year as well.
So what's the problem now?
Well, I think over the past 100 years, we've had a major impact on the fire regimes and the amount of fire that's been occurring on the landscape in Alberta. And what that has done is it has started to shift the land or the age class distribution to a much older forest than maybe it ever has been. Historically, there would have been natural fires either caused by lightning or First Nations lit fires that would have maintained a certain amount of young forest on the landscape. And by reducing the amount of fires on the landscape, we're really starting to lose that young forest. And that it's that young forest that's highly productive from an ungulate and a number of wildlife species from their standpoint.
So how much of a percentage have we lost?
Well, it depends on the area that you look at. Some of the data that I've been able to analyze so far, well, one example would be the Montane area along Kootenai Plains. We've actually probably seen about an 85% reduction in the amount of forest that's less than 50 years old.
That's just amazing. Well, one of the things that's been going on over the last few years has been an attempt to deal with this fire suppression. There actually have been programs to go in and prescribe burns. Is that not working?
Well, it is working when it's occurring. One of the things that we've tried to do is use prescribed burning to try to restore some of this young forest habitat. One of the limitations is that prescribed burning relies on a certain set of environmental conditions to be able to light the fire. You want to, of course, be able to light the fire in safe conditions. You want to be able to control the fire. That's the key to prescribed burning. But with the conditions that we've had recently, because there's more fuel out on the landscape, there's more concern about fires getting away, and so you have to ensure that the fire, that the environmental conditions are right, that you get the right precipitation, etc. And so it's not always necessarily an easy task, but there certainly is more emphasis being put on getting more prescribed burns out there.
You've been going through with the Alberta Conservation Association a reassessment of the program for improving the winter range. What is it that you're doing now?
Well, we're really trying to take a look at our program. We've been able to achieve, I think, some positive effects for wildlife, but we really want to make sure that we're getting the best results that we possibly can. And so we want to make our program more effective through a strategic planning process. I think in the past we've had different areas where we've been doing projects, but we haven't necessarily done as good of a job of being coordinated within our own organization maybe as we could have been. So that's one of the things that we're concentrating on, is putting together a new ecosystem management strategic planning process to sort of ensure that we're all working towards the same objectives. And we're using an ecosystem management approach to be able to incorporate the best science that's out there in terms of setting our objectives, as well as to ensure that our program, which is focused on ungulate winter range, has the best results for not only ungulates but also a wide range of other species.
What might some of those other species be?
A number of other species have been affected by changes to fire patterns in Alberta. There's been some work done by researchers at the University of Alberta looking at the effects that have been occurring to butterflies as a result of meadows being infilled by forest. And grizzly bears are another species that have had habitat value reduced by a lack of fire in the province.
So how are you going to coordinate what your objectives are with, say, some other groups that are looking at improving habitat for either grizzly bears or butterflies, as you say?
Well, one of the things that we did right off the bat was we decided to build our program, or our revised program, around watershed subbasins. That's going to be our planning unit, and then within that, looking at natural subregions. So that allows us to be able to sit down with other groups that are looking at issues, everything from water quality to other habitat, other species habitat, and be able to talk about defined areas where we all have different, maybe slightly different objectives, but areas where we can work together. And so In terms of working with other groups, we have some objectives for ensuring that we're not having a negative impact on threatened species. So we have to work with those that are involved with caribou restoration work, as well as some of the grizzly bear habitat modeling that's been done by the Foothills Model Forest.
How do you deal with changing public opinion? Certainly the public wants to see older forests out there, but you've said that historically we haven't really had that many older forests. And also, from a public perspective, we've always been taught fire is a bad thing. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think part of it is public education. I know even for myself, I grew up with the message that fire was bad and fire had to be reported and put out. It wasn't really until I started looking at some of the stand age data that I really started to realize that, man, we've had a major impact on the ecosystem by putting out these fires. And putting out fires is important. We do it to protect our communities and our livelihoods, and that is an important thing. But we also have to realize that we have had an impact on the ecosystem by doing that. And I think just educating people about that impact and making people realize that, yes, mature forest is important. Old age forest is very important as well. But all those things should fall within the natural range of variability. And I think the problem that we're getting into now is that we're moving away from a natural variability on the young end. And we're actually ending up with an important component of the ecosystem is missing.
What are you going to be doing through this next year?
Well, going to be continuing on our planning process. We're working on plans for some priority watershed sub-basins. So we'll be setting objectives for age class distributions, which will help us to identify areas where treatments are the most appropriate. And then we're going to be working with our existing partners. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has been a big partner in terms of funding for our program. But I really want to try to expand on that and bring in other groups. There are other hunting conservation groups that I think will probably be interested in this program. But even going beyond that to other environmental groups and certainly government groups, and really start to produce a program that can be used to achieve a number of objectives.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Well, thank you.
That was Robert Anderson, a wildlife biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association in Rocky Mountain House. This year, the Venture Prize Business Plan competition went province-wide, and it featured a new category called Kickstart. This is designed to help smaller entrepreneurial ventures get up and running. Four finalists pitched their innovative ideas and plans to an audience of business professionals gathered in the Alberta Research Council Theatre. It was a tough choice, but in the end, the judges chose Waxwords Inc. as the first Venture Prize Kickstart champion. The entrepreneur behind this new approach to greeting cards is Peter Bocas of Calgary. Peter goes home with $7,000 in cash and $5,000 in support services to help make his dream a reality.
Honestly, I'm still numb. I didn't expect a lot out of this competition other than a very good feedback from my business plan. And to get to this point is just amazing. Like, in nowhere did I think I would make it, especially to this point.
Peter, tell me about your product, the Waxword cards.
Waxwords cards are combined wax with traditional cardstock in unique and innovative ways. And the wax portion can be removed to roll into a full-size candle. So it's a pretty simple concept, but there are many different applications for it. And I'm just looking forward to hopefully getting a lot of those out the door very quickly.
Where did the idea come from?
Well, my idea came, is my idea, came while we were rolling wedding appreciation gifts for, obviously, our wedding. I rolled about 100 out of the 400 candles that we needed to do, and it became a little old to me, and I had this idea. So we would just put some wax and a wick on a card stock with some directions, and have the guests roll their own candle while they're sitting at the tables waiting through the speeches and the toasts, and it gives them something to do. And, my wife, she thought that that was a way to get out of my commitment, and obviously didn't want to set any kind of precedent that way. So I rolled a lot of candles after that. She did help, I got to admit. She did probably about half of them.
Well, taking that from an appreciation gift for a wedding and then turning it into a business, that's a big leap to take.
That's a huge leap, I know. That just shows our commitment to this particular product. We've always been excited about it, its potential. Everyone that we talk to is just amazed that this thing of our products, that it works so well. And, you know, it's very unique. And obviously no one's seen it before. And I just hope that we can introduce it well into the marketplace.
Now, the Venture Prize competition is based on making a business plan and having a good business plan. What's your business plan?
You know, it's pretty well documented what my steps are. We've followed it very closely to this point, and we are on track. So, you know, I'm hoping to continue that, and I believe that we have the right vision, and we will be able to succeed hopefully fairly shortly.
How will you be marketing?
We will attend gift and trade shows. Word of mouth has been big for us, just for local sales. But, you know, hopefully with especially winning this competition, this is going to give us some more exposure, something that we, you know, very happy to get. And distributorship. We'll hope for national distributorship, you know, possibly. And, you know, there are other products that we're going to have that aren't, you know, solely based on this original concept.
Any words of advice for others who would follow in your footsteps as you become the Waxword King of North America?
Waxword King. Yeah, you know what? You got something that you think is going to do well. You've got the commitment and the drive to make it succeed. Then go for it. Just, you know, go for it, because you've got nothing to lose, honestly.
What did you learn going through the Venture Prize competition?
They taught me to work very quickly under a limited amount of time. Put in very long hours for my plan to get to them. And they did step you through the process, which was an excellent process to go through. So they did give you some ideas. Some direction was fabulous while you're doing this. It's, you know, without that, you're just spinning your wheels.
That was Peter Bocas, president of Waxwords, Inc., and the first Kickstart champion in the Venture Prize Business Plan competition. Also receiving awards in the Kickstart category were Joanne Vasing of Saucy Cucina, Trevor Brown of Wave Control, and Hugh Dancer of Instadeck. The Venture Prize grand prize winner will be announced on March 22nd. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Calgary Technologies, Inc., the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Innovation and Science, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.